The following A2A one-on-one feature is a production of the nonprofit Adversity to Advocacy Alliance. The views and opinions expressed by our guests do not necessarily reflect those of A2A, our advocates, allies, or ally organizations. We hope you'll find this interview both informative and inspiring.
Hi there, I'm Jeff Bell, speaking one-on-one today with Chrissy Hodges, a mental health advocate and public speaker on what's often referred to as Pure O, obsessive compulsive disorder, and also on suicide prevention. Chrissy lives in Denver, Colorado, and hosts a weekly Mental Illness Matters podcast. Chrissy, thanks so much for making some time for us to sit down and chat and tell us about your amazing journey from adversity to advocacy.
Thank you for having me, Jeff. It is such an honor to be part of this.
I want to talk about the early years for Chrissy Hodges. At what point did you realize that you were battling some challenges?
I would say my life changed when I was 8 years old. However, I had no concept of what was happening to me. And in an 8-year-old mind, the only way I knew how to relate to these huge changes, meaning one day being a normal everyday kid playing Atari, riding bikes, to the next day being riddled with anxiety 24/7 with these huge compulsions in my mind, the only way to make sense out of that was to think that I had done something wrong to offend a higher power. We were very religious, and in my mind, an 8-year-old mind, it's good things happen to good people, bad things happen to bad people. So maybe I've done something bad to offend God. And all of a sudden I went into this, which is called scrupulosity, where the anxiety and these compulsive behaviors and these horrible obsessions I was and horrible thoughts I was having, I thought were a result of doing something bad that I needed to ask forgiveness for.
What did your folks tell you in terms of what might be going on? I mean, I'm realizing we're backing up some years here, and OCD was not part of our national discussion the way it is today. Did they have a sense of what was going on?
I hid everything for 12 years. No one knew anything. The first day that OCD appeared, I saw my mom coming in to pick me up from after school program, and I desperately wanted to tell her. I wanted to run into her arms and have her hold me and tell me that everything was going to be okay. But Jeff, I was too ashamed and embarrassed. I had developed this ridiculous fear of throwing up that day, and I felt so stupid. What kind of person is worrying about this? And I was scared that she would think that I was a bad person because I thought that God was punishing me. And everything in my being was desperate to tell her, and so I could get some comfort and reassurance. But the OCD part of my brain said, keep your mouth shut, Chrissy. And I did for 12 years. And in the course of that 12 years, developed horrible sexual obsessions and some violent obsessions, all the while depicting this image of perfection to the outside world. My family, during that time, like later in hindsight, said, well, we always knew you were the, quote, anxious child, but they had no idea it was as severe as it was. Typically, people who have my type of OCD, they become very good actors, and most of the energy is put toward hiding the obsessions and the compulsions.
What was the turning point in terms of seeking treatment?
So my junior year of college, my cousin passed away, and he was one of my best friends, and it was unexpected. So change is a big trigger for me. And I fell into a very deep depression. And this was over the course of months. Every sign was there. You know, I lost weight. My cross-country performance dwindled. My grades went down. But never did anyone think to ask, are you suicidal? Never did I think, I'm going to say this out loud, because of the shame and the guilt and the embarrassment. And you know, people like us don't get depressed or would attempt suicide. And so that weighed heavily on my mind. And that was the turning point for me. And it got to a point where I like to describe it as I was so numb by the time I attempted suicide that if I could even feel fear, it would have been a reason to stay alive.
And obviously you were very lucky to be alive today. Tell us about the aftermath of the attempt.
I had to have a physical surgery for a self-inflicted wound. And then I went into the psychiatric hospital, which was really tough. I was thinking, I'm not one of those people. And, you know, I had this vision, you know, Jack Nicholson and, you know, One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest.
And you're how old at this point?
I was 20. I was 20 years old. And it was in the psychiatric facility where I met my first peers. And these were, once I finally stopped being a brat and started opening up and talking to them, these were parents. They were husbands and wives. They had jobs. And they made me laugh, and I made them laugh, and they were the first people that knew everything about me. I'd kept the secret for 12 years and still liked me. And then I was diagnosed with OCD, and my first thought was, I'm not one of those crazy hand-washing people.
Oh, you mean like me?
Exactly. And even I think the therapist at the time was like, I think this is OCD, but I'm not really sure. But I was on medication for the first year, and that really turned things around for me. It works very well for me. And then, of course, I got off medication thinking, oh, I can control this. I'm smart enough. And I relapsed. And, Jeff, I think that was the turning point for me. That's when, and I feel very lucky, and I know a lot of people don't have this luck. I just, you know, I had the resources and I had the support to advocate for myself. And that's when I went online, and this was 1998 internet, so it took me a long time. And
dial-up, AOL.
Exactly. And that's when I did the research. I had the courage to do the research about my type of OCD, because that's difficult to have to type the sexual and violent obsessions in. And I found an OCD specialist in New York, and I started ERP immediately. And ERP is hard, and I knew nothing about it, but I just said whatever it takes to be able to get a handle on this, and that's essentially when things changed for me.
At what point did you realize that you wanted to share your story, that you wanted to step into advocacy?
So this is interesting. When I was going through ERP, I'm sitting on the steps of the psychology building, you know, still feeling horrible because I had to get off meds to do ERP. He wanted me to. And so I'm thinking, but I'm starting to see the change, you know, one step at a time. And I'm thinking, oh my gosh, this could really happen. I could really live successfully with this. And I looked up into the sky and I thought, what if one day I could share my story and one person could benefit from this? One person. And then my OCD quickly shut that down. No way, you are not talking about this. Everybody would judge you. People would reject you. And I remember thinking, okay, yeah. Probably. And Jeff, for the next 14 years, I entered the stage of recovery called Life is Limited, where you are saturated in shame and guilt and embarrassment for mental illness and, you know, and definitely grieving the trauma of the suicide attempt. And Life is Limited doesn't mean that I stayed in at home and didn't do anything, but there was a quality of happiness and freedom missing. And so I lived in anger. And then 14 years after that, I relapsed. I moved to Denver, big change. And it was in that relapse that I started really diving into, Chrissy, this is never going to go away. So you've got a choice. You can either be angry for the rest of your life, or you can do something to make a difference. And this is your chance. And Jeff Bell, I went and looked up the IOCDF, and I saw your face, and I saw Liz's face, and I just held on to hope because of the two of you and thought, if they can do it, I can do it. Now, granted, my type of OCD is not one that you want to go blast out to the masses, but you know what? I took the first step, which is the next stage in recovery, and that is just that fragile flame of hope and just thinking up a change to make things better, and I went to Toastmasters.
So this wasn't a natural gift, because for those who have not heard Chrissy speak, she's a phenomenal speaker. So passionate, so energetic, so entertaining, so engaging. You had to build those skills, huh?
Yes, and on top of an emotional topic too, yeah. which made it more difficult. And At first, I definitely had some, I was really nervous and I would sweat and cry and everything else. But I do think that there is some natural ability. My dad is a minister. I grew up watching him and just how engaging he is. So I do think I have that natural ability, but oh yeah, I had to build it, especially when it came to the topic of OCD and mental illness.
You are doing so much advocacy these days in the OCD arena, in the broader anti-stigma arena. You talk about suicide prevention. Mm-hmm. Give us a quick rundown of what you're doing.
Well, my primary focus and my primary passion is peer support. This stems from being in the psychiatric hospital and meeting those people that understand mental illness and accept you, and I just felt alive being around people that just understood. So my job is I work as a peer support specialist in Colorado, and I work in the institution. So I am at the ground floor, people who are in the locked units, just to provide hope. Just that little shining ray of hope of, hey, let's laugh today. Let's play some cards. Let's remind you that you have a life outside of this illness. So that's my big passion. I do that. I also work with an OCD specialist in Denver with his patients who need that bump of support or some coaching through ERP. I still do my podcast, Mental Illness Matters Radio, and we tackle topics that have to do with mental illness. And then I'm a presenter at the Crisis Intervention Training for the Denver Police and Sheriff Department, which is awesome.
As you know, we have a little tagline for A2A, we help ourselves by helping others. Mm-hmm. And I know from conversations we've had before that this is something that resonates for you. Talk about some of the ways that your advocacy is helping you.
Oh my goodness, I could go on for hours about this. I like to think that once I took the first step into advocacy, it shoved me completely into recovery. And Jeff, that's the opposite. That's not a natural thing that you would think would happen. I was assuming the moment I started talking about these things that it would bring up trauma and and people would judge me and reject me. And, you know, I'd still have that twinge of people are going to judge me when I stand up to speak. But what it does is it really releases all of that negative emotion, and it brings you closer to people that you would never think are struggling. You know, you cannot ever look at someone and say, oh, they have it all together, or they have the, I mean, I'm a testament, 12 years with OCD and no one knew. And so it helps me just knowing that my story can touch someone in the depths of their suffering. They may hear something that I say and it resonates. They can't tell me, they can't tell anyone, but they go home that night and think, I'm not alone, and maybe they do some research on the internet and maybe they get help. So I guess I can't articulate how helping others helps me, but I can say that if it wasn't for this advocacy and for speaking out about my story, I would not be as far into recovery as I am now.
Chrissy Hodges, thanks so much for making some time.
Thank you so much for having me, Jeff. Always a pleasure.
You've been listening to A2A One-on-One, an outreach project of the nonprofit Adversity to Advocacy Alliance. To listen to other one-on-one interviews and to learn more about A2A, please visit us online at a2aalliance.org. And thanks for helping us spread the word that we help ourselves by helping others.